This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Before we start, though, we'd like to acknowledge the old man, Nabi Antarna, who's passed away, and we've been given permission to show this picture of Nabi, his wife Polly, who's still alive, and all the grandkids, who are now not so small, actually, they've all got their own children. But Nabi was the old man who took us around Salt Lake, and we camped for many months around Salt Lake in the 1990s, living with him and his family and recording the rock art and looking at the old camping places. This is one of the many places that we actually worked on around Groot Island. I worked with Thomas's sister, his mother and his grandmother and his brother, and there's some other people in the audience too whose relatives I worked with. So this photograph is just really to acknowledge his contribution to our research. Okay? All right, I'll start. The American-Australian scientific expedition to Arnhem Land was an astounding initiative, not only due to its scale, logistics and multidisciplinary scope of its vision, but also because it was kind of historical reenactment, a project performing the investigative urges of an earlier era in modern times. However, one respect in which the Arnhem Land expedition differed from past exploratory ventures was it advanced the science of archaeology as a field of study. And as one of two archaeologists involved in the expedition, Frederick McCarthy spent 14 weeks on Groot Island recording rock art sites and carrying out excavations with his American colleague Frank Setzler. And it is in this context that McCarthy's involvement in the expedition may be seen as both a contribution to the scientific understanding of Arnhem Land and Groot Island, as well as a reflection of an emergent Australian discipline. And during his time on Groot Island, McCarthy recorded some 2,400 rock art motifs at three key site complexes, Chasm Island, Angorogo or Anurugu, and Junduruna. Next. His application of a systematic field methodology to record the art and his subsequent interpretations mark a definitive period in the development of rock art research in Australia. In this paper, we revisit McCarthy's study in order to place our own archaeological research on Groot Island in its historical context. We discuss the rock art and archaeology from one rock shelter on Groot Island, called Angrokbunna, to assess the ongoing relevance of McCarthy's research and to illustrate how our own field project is tied into a trajectory of theory, method and practice in archaeology in Arnhem Land that both builds on and substantially departs from McCarthy's legacy. Prior to 1948, very little specialised archaeological research had been undertaken in Australia. In northern Australia, the only previously reported excavations were those carried out by the anthropologist W.L. Warner in 1927 at two shell mounds in the Millingimby region, including the Macassar Well site, which was later re-examined by McCarthy and Setzler, and you saw some pictures earlier of those excavations. McCarthy and Setzler identified that their primary aim was to determine the origin, or at least the prehistory, of the Australian Aborigines in Arnhem Land. But at the time of their fieldwork, there were no methods for measuring past chronologies, and they were reliant on creating timelines based on relative dating through establishing sequences of artefact types. Groot Island, though, was the first location for the expedition and the archaeological research projects. McCarthy and Setzler's investigations, including excavating a Macassan burial, as we've just seen, digging a shallow shell deposit on Winchelsea Island, again, as we've heard, collecting skeletons from Bartolumba Bay, trenching a shell deposit in Thompson Bay and examining surface campsites in Hempel Bay and making an extensive recording of rock art sites. Yet the archaeology they encountered on Groot Island did not fulfil their aims. They stated, no site suitable for excavation was found on the island, but a more detailed search than time and facilities permitted might yield better results. And they then went on to say that all the sites examined suggested a comparatively short period of occupation of the island by the Aborigines. Disappointingly, I think, we get little picture of the indigenous archaeology on Groot Island. And despite their efforts to locate and excavate as many stratified archaeological sites across Arnhem Land as possible, McCarthy and Setzler struggled with the low numbers of formal artefact types they found in the sites. Chronology proved elusive, and they noted that the excavated deposits appeared to be relatively recent, a fact which they found surprising, given that they expected Arnhem Land to contain the evidence of the oldest occupation of the continent. By contrast with the apparent dearth of archaeological deposits, a large number of rock art sites were investigated by Frederick McCarthy. His recording and analysis of the rock art is based upon a classification system he developed specially for the Groote Eylandt and Chasm Island rock art assemblages. His methods were both physically and demanding and original, which he realised even then would set an impressive new standard. McCarthy noted that the rock art of Groote Eylandt displays a wide range of styles and colours, and he developed a three-phase sequence. This sequence was defined by the identification of specific objects of material culture in the art, namely the axe and the canoe. And as such, these phases are established on the basis of contact with outsiders, the Macassans and the Europeans or Anglo-Australians. So his earliest stage of painting is defined as the early stone axe and bark canoe period, as differentiated from the intermediate Macassan with the dugout canoe and metal axe, followed by the recent European period with another type of metal axe. On the basis of the dugout canoe and its representation in the rock art, McCarthy proposed that the majority of Groote Eylandt art was made during cross-cultural interaction with outsiders. In 1990, I went to Groote Eylandt to carry out an archaeological study of the sort that was at the time fairly conventional approach to fieldwork in Australian archaeology. The aim was to find one or two deep rock shelter sites that would allow a long chronological and cultural sequence of human history to be established, much in the vein of Carmel Schreer's pioneering research in Western Arnhem Land. And perhaps in this sense, my preliminary search ideas fell squarely into line with what McCarthy and Setzler had set out to achieve all those years ago, albeit aided by more modern analytical techniques and dating methods. However, the process of living and working with Indigenous families transformed the project from one concerned with deep time and long cultural sequences to one focused on community-based approaches to archaeological research and the archaeology of cross-cultural interactions or contact in the recent coastal landscape. And this transformation occurred as a result of working with Indigenous families who showed me their history, their old people's camping places, and in the end it produced quite different results than those achieved by more traditional archaeological approaches orientated towards identifying deeply stratified deposits. So I directed the focus of my study to the many shallow shell middens and rock shelters, similar to those, as you saw, were dismissed earlier by McCarthy and Setzler, and many of which have proved to contain evidence of Aboriginal interactions with both the Macassans and the Europeans. We added a study of the rock art to the project in the mid-1990s when Ursula joined the project, and a specific aim of the rock art project was to investigate the ways in which Indigenous artists were choosing to represent their interactions with outsiders through their rock art. During a preliminary exploration in 1992 with Nabi and his family, we found a small rocky outcrop containing a painted shelter in an area called Angrokbunna. This area is located on the southeastern shore of Salt Lake, and we saw some footage of Salt Lake earlier in the films, which is part of Yantarlana clan lands. And we worked with Nabi and his family for all of our fieldwork in this area, bush camping for weeks at a time around the shores of Salt Lake. The Angrokbunna rock shelter is located 500 metres south of the lake and 3.5 kilometres inland from the coast to the east. The walls and ceiling of the rock shelter are densely painted, and the rock shelter floor is sandy with marine shells and old firewood visible on the surface. In conjunction with our Indigenous co-workers, Angrokbunna was mapped and photographed and excavated during two field seasons in 1992 and 1995. The cultural material we excavated consists of shell, stone artefacts and some ochre. The very acid soil conditions limited the preservation of the shell and the fish bone, and much of it was too fragmentary to identify to species. However, we were able to identify some fish, some sharks, some mammal, crab and reptiles. Over 130 stone artefacts were recovered, and many of these were made by people from locally available quartz pebbles. A few artefacts were made from chert, and there was one artefact made from a fine pink silkreet, which may have come from the Nilipuji quarry on the Walker River on the mainland. A large quantity of worked ochre was also recovered from the site, and about one-fifth of this has evidence of use in the form of ground facets and striations. Red ochre was the main pigment present, and it varied from coarse-grained nodules of laterite to very fine-grained soft ochres. And other pigment colours from the excavations included yellow, purple and white. Radiocarbon dates from three charcoal samples at the site showed us that people first lived there about 2,700 years ago, and the site continued to be visited and used as a shelter sometime into the mid-20th century. Rock art covers much of the Angrokbunna shelter. It varies in size and subject, from schematic human figures to the compelling centrepiece on the shelter ceiling, a depiction of a Macassan prow complete with its crew and provisions, composed in three colours with an X-ray view of the interior hull. We classify the Angwokbuna art assemblage according to the technique, the subject, the number and colour of pigments used, and the formal characteristics of the motifs displayed. We recorded something like 47 distinct rock art motifs, most of which were paintings in a figurative style. Three techniques were used in the production of the art. People stenciled, they painted, and they drew. But the great majority of the assemblage was composed of paintings. Most of the paintings were produced using only one colour, and 22% were made using two colours, and only one recorded painting, that of the prow, used three colours. A number of the rock art motifs may be considered as single subjects, but there are several which appear to be grouped in compositions of stylistically related forms. Amongst the subjects present, human figures dominate the assemblage, and many of these human figures are arranged in compositions, such as groups of dancers or people fishing from dugout canoes. More unusual arrangements include several camping scenes depicting families sleeping inside bark shelters, and that picture that we saw just before this one was how the old Yantarna man explained that's what that painting was. It was people camping inside their bark shelters, and we feel that this reflects a much more intimate view of the everyday lives of indigenous families. And we also get amongst these domestic scenes representations of turtle and fish and reptiles and dogs. And unlike McCarthy and his sequence, there are very few representations of material culture, apart from the two dugout canoes and the large prow. And we certainly don't have the wallabies, which were highly prevalent in the kind of data that McCarthy recorded at the rock art sites that he visited. We've identified a number of superimposed paintings that go towards defining a sequence at Angwokbuna, and on the basis of these observations, we're able to suggest that the sort of sequence goes that there's red silhouette and purple-red linear infill style are amongst the earliest art. Silhouettes and line paintings of human figures were continued until the most recent episodes of paintings. Two colour paintings in red and yellow have been partially obscured by subsequent paintings employing a white pigment, and it is clear that white was the most recent colour used in the art, examples including a turtle with tracks and the numerous human figures. The superpositioning of the art at Angwokbuna enabled us to consider McCarthy's own sequence and to revisit a number of his interpretations. And using McCarthy's own chronology, Angwokbuna might best fit with the intermediate period, which he suggests much of the art on the island was made. It's a period that he believes corresponds to contact with the Macassans, but for which he could ascribe no firm time frame. The impressive prow and the dugout canoes appear to be associated at Angwokbuna with this contact tradition. For the most part, the Angwokbuna rock art conforms to McCarthy's summation that silhouettes are the dominant style of Groote Eylandt rock art. Indeed, paintings of this kind comprise almost half of the rock art at Angwokbuna. Outline and design styles, line design styles are also common. However, stencils, hand stencils and artifact stencils, did not occur in the frequencies observed, and are only a minor part of the Angwokbuna assemblage, the frequencies that McCarthy observed. In terms of subject matter, there are some remarkable contrasts to McCarthy's Groote Eylandt data. There are more human figures. Almost half of the human identified motifs depict humans, either as solitary figures or in groups. And whilst this is in keeping with the high proportion of human figures McCarthy recorded, it's somewhat at odds with his suggestion that the human figure does not feature so prominently, which is one of his quotes. In many other ways, the art at Angwokbuna departs from McCarthy's analysis and general conclusions. The dominance of white pigment at Angwokbuna is one key difference with McCarthy's data, where he records it as only an infrequent occurrence. And another example is the prow, which has no comparison in McCarthy's data. The painting incorporates three colours, red, pink and white, in a style combining silhouette, outline and infill. So despite his groundbreaking efforts to link archaeology and art and modernise the study of rock art in Australia, McCarthy's reliance on material culture was also a constraint in his interpretation. Rather than drawing upon the styles and the superpositioning relationships he exhaustively documented in the rock art, his sequence ultimately relies on the representation of objects, which may be uncommon or difficult to sort of look at and discern objectively. So it's hardly surprising then that despite the variability in content, colour and style evident at Angwok Buna, McCarthy's three-phase sequence cannot be really strongly validated by what we were able to see. Linking the art and archaeology, the evidence from Angwok Buna indicates that 2,700 years ago, between 2,700 years ago and about 1,700 years ago, the rock shelter was a place where Aboriginal people from Groote Eylandt went to paint, they went to camp, and they went to make stone artefacts from all that locally available stone. The lower deposit, part of the deposit, contains a large amount of discarded ochre, including partially used up crayons and ochres of all different colours. And this to us suggests that at that time, 2,700 years ago and up to about 1,700 years ago, Indigenous people were able to had access to a plentiful supply of ochre and did not need to sort of curate it, were able to go back and get continual access to that ochre. However, after about 1,700 years ago, there were fewer stone artefacts actually left behind in the deposit, and painting appears to have continued, but all we found in the deposit were the red ochres, and those were the only ones that discarded in any quantity. And if we think about the art sequence, we can think about this in a number of ways. It's quite possible that people were more carefully curating ochres at this later period because it become harder to obtain, possibly because the seasonal presence of macassans had disrupted supplies or access to particular ochre supplies, or indeed the presence of macassans had affected the existing processes of art production. It's also possible that art production was more intensive in this recent phase of occupation, engendered and inspired by the presence of macassans, so that all the painting, all the pigments and all the ochres were used up and very little was then thrown away onto the floor of the deposit. And given the evidence from the art sequence and the archaeology, we think this is the most likely explanation. So when Fred McCarthy set out in 1948 to investigate the cave paintings of Groote Eylandt and Chasm Island, his stated purpose was to ascertain the fundamental characteristics and chronology of Groote Eylandt and Chasm Island rock art. Two particular features exemplify his approach and signal the emergence of the archaeology of art as a discipline of study. First was his systematic attention to recording rock art to scale and in its entirety, and second was his desire to link rock art to stratified archaeological deposits. His comprehensive illustrations, tables and notes suggest that he was able to provide a complete record of the art represented in the groups recorded, and that's his quote. But his second goal remained elusive, that he was unable to link the archaeology and the art and the archaeology. Despite this limitation, one of the enduring legacies of McCarthy's research on Groote Eylandt was in cementing a place for the scholarly investigation of rock art in Australia and in producing a record of the rock art in Groote Eylandt that still lends itself to analysis in the present day. The archaeological research, on the other hand, has proved less robust. From a historical perspective, the 12 years from fieldwork in 1948 to publication in 1960 can now be understood as a crucial period in the development of global archaeology. It was a time period when the discipline underwent a rapid change. The now familiar methods of modern archaeology, such as radiocarbon dating, and the analyses of past environments and economic systems using shell, faunal, and botanical remains were fast becoming integral to research projects in Europe and the United States of America. So against this backdrop of radical transformation, the expedition's Archaeology of Arnhem Land is a curiously anachronistic account of the pre-European history of the region. And it's more a reflection of a nascent Antipodean discipline than a programmatic example of the research potential of Australian archaeology. And it was, of course, only a short time after the publication of the expedition that Australian archaeology entered a key phase of intellectual growth and discovery, with Pleistocene dates for Indigenous occupation announced in 1962 by John Mulvaney at Kenneth Cave in Queensland and in 1964 by Carmel White, Shrier, in Kakadu. The innovative sea change our research is making, we would hope to suggest, is our focus on the art and archaeology of cross-cultural interactions from the perspective of the Indigenous archaeological record rather than the material record left by the outsiders, the macassans and the Europeans. In addition, our research was explicitly embedded for the duration of the fieldwork within a community-based approach, and this moves the research process beyond describing Indigenous people as informants or the ubiquitous native of the expedition report, to one where fieldwork methods, research questions and the everyday experience of doing archaeology as part of a family or a community group is a negotiated process. And while McCarthy undoubtedly worked closely with Indigenous people on Groote Eylandt, his field research and published writing remains firmly within the realm of archaeology as a colonial practice. And even though he shared the daily activities of camping, fishing and hunting with Indigenous families on Groote Eylandt, these experiences remain at a distance from his published archaeological research. These observations are not made to denigrate or demote his achievements on the expedition, but more to explain that contemporary archaeological practice has moved in a direction that seeks to break down those artificial dissonances between past and present, prehistory and history, scientist and native, to a position where Indigenous knowledge and community concerns are as integral to the research process as systematic recording methods. The Groote Eylandt Ursa and I came to know was more than a suite of old camping places to be collected. The landscape of rock art and archaeology, revealed to us by all the people, Indigenous families we worked with, was a living terrain shaped and enriched by the everyday activities and necessities involved on living in country. And as a result of this engagement, we've been able to locate sites, of which Angwakbunna is just one example, where there is both rock art and an archaeological deposit, and so have begun the kind of integrated interpretation that McCarthy and Setzler sought all those years ago. Thank you.
We have time for one question or comment, but we do have 20 minutes or so at the end of the day. So if there's any now, we'll take it. Otherwise, you can reserve it till the end. Louise, thank you.
Thanks for both of you. I'd like to sort of direct my question about the archaeology into the areas that I know a little bit about, so maybe you can enlighten me a bit more. Everyone, I think, is pretty aware that Fred McCarthy did have a very intense interest in material culture. And I wasn't really clear about your comment about... I'm not sure if you were saying that that got in the way of his analysis of the rock art, or was he just disappointed that he couldn't find those things in the rock art? I'm just unclear about the relationship between the images that were found at Groote with his own personal interests.
Sorry, it probably wasn't clear enough in the cut-down version. I was saying that his use of kind of specific objects to define his sequences does get in the way of the action. I mean, his recordings are incredibly detailed, and he recorded all these sequences and superimpositions, if you like, a history. It's a bit like layers of art. But his whole sequence is based on the identification of particular objects, but they don't always occur in the rock art. So in a sense, it's kind of getting... They only occur in one site, actually Anuragu, the Anuragu site up the back of the Anuragu settlement, particularly those axes. So he really didn't sort of take, in a sense, into account his own data. And the other interesting thing, too, is that, I mean, part of the, I suppose, the frustration that he and Setzler describe in their, in their report, They were struggling with chronology, and what they expected to find were, sort of types of stone tools that change over time, so it goes from sort of big pointy ones to small pointy ones, or however they change, they expected a sequence. They also expected, and it's interesting, yesterday Peter Veth mentioned Julian Stewart, who is a cultural ecologist, and of course Frank Setzler was one of his colleagues, and what they were used to in the American excavations where Stewart was working was getting very fine... basket work and clothes and a whole range of other kinds of material culture. And they expected to be able to kind of create a cultural sequence in Arnhem Land based on not just stone artefacts but also basket work, bone points from fishing spears or basket work, spear points, all those kinds of organic artefacts that they'd actually, Setzler was used to finding in the American sites. And they also, one of the comments they make is that they were actually disappointed they didn't find any of these things in the archaeological deposits and that there was no correlation between what they saw Aboriginal people in the camps using and what they were able to see in the rock shelter sites. So they really didn't have, at that point in time, the tools to understand the kinds of archaeological sites that occur in northern Australia outside of the really deep rock shelter sequences. So one of the things, you know, they dismissed what the quote is, something they only had shallow deposits of shell and pandanus nuts. To us, as an archaeologist, that's really exciting, you know, in the sense that there are pandanus nuts and shallow shells, because we now have the methodological tools to kind of understand the very sort of dispersed places where people camp on the beach, on the back of the beach, on the dunes, and have a look at those shells. And we have the techniques to date them and understand the kind of, you know, how people are going to different environments over time to make a living from the sea and from the sort of landscape. So they struggled because of the expectations at the time of what archaeology should produce. And yes, it was bound up with particular viewpoint about artefact types and what they thought should occur in rock shelter sites. And it's actually very rare in Australia to find organic artefacts, you know, bits of dilly bag or spear points. And in fact, the first research I ever did up in Kakadu with Rhys Jones and Betty Min and people on the project they did in the 1980s was actually looking at all of that kind of material where there was fantastic preservation, even little Banksia fire lighters and fire sticks. So occasionally those beautiful, you know, those bits of material culture do survive, but not very often because of the soil conditions, essentially. Is that... to answer your question?
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.